ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय I'm going to shorten the process here and just go straight into reading the verse as we read this verse yesterday also. Yadyan niruktam vachasa nirupitam dhyakshabhir vamanasotayasya ma Ma bhut swarupam gunarupam hi tat tat
Ma bhut swarupam gunarupam hi tat tat
Savai gunapaya visarga lakshanaha
Savai gunapaya visarga lakshanaha
Translation. Anything expressed by material vibrations. Anything ascertained by material intelligence. And anything experienced by the material senses or concocted within the material mind is but an effect of the modes of material nature and therefore has nothing to do with the real nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Lord is beyond the creation of this material world, for He is the source of the material qualities and creation. As the cause of all causes, He exists before the creation and after the creation. I wish to offer my respectful obeisances unto Him. I'll just read the first paragraph of the purport as we read it yesterday, and it's quite long. One who manufactures names, forms, qualities, or paraphernalia pertaining to the Supreme Personality of Godhead cannot understand Him, since He is beyond creation. The Supreme Lord is the creator of everything, and this means that He existed when there was no creation. In other words, His name, form, and qualities are not materially created entities. They are transcendental always. Therefore, by our material concoctions, vibrations, and thoughts, we cannot ascertain the Supreme Lord. This is explained in the verse, Atashri Krishna Namadi Nabhavad Grahim Indriyahi. I wanted to speak on this verse again because the topic is so important. It comes as the last in a series of verses which describe how the Supreme Truth, the Personality of Godhead, is not understandable by the material intelligence. And is understandable by His mercy. Very important topic. In one sense, it should be that simply by understanding or accepting that I'm an eternal servant of Krishna, that everything should become clear. But to actually understand the ramifications that I am an eternal servant of Krishna, it seems to be very difficult to understand. It's not just a matter of understanding theoretically, but actually placing oneself in that position, mentally placing oneself in that position. Because every living being, especially in the human form of life, the consciousness is more developed, but every living being is a conglomerate of, I mean, apart from the gross body, but the subtle body, the consciousness, is a conglomerate of previous impressions, ongoing present impressions, opinions, or general outlook on life, and desires. It's all very, very complex. But very deep in the consciousness of the conditioned soul is the presumption that I I am meant to enjoy everything around me. And two, and not only everything around me, but he can plan on accumulating more things to enjoy, or daydream about doing so. Everyone is very self-centered. That's very difficult to get free from, because we are very much grounded in ourself. We experience our own experiences is all that we are, it seems. What am I? I'm the experience of the sensory perceptions all around me. But to understand that I'm a servant of Krishna means that I have a completely different function to that which seems axiomatically to be what I am. And there's an energy of the Supreme Lord, his external energy, which reinforces that, helps us, or gives us the ability to think like that, and the desire to enjoy this material world is reinforced by Maya, who offers so many possibilities for us to do so, and the thought processes by which we presume it to be normal and proper, justified and correct. So it's very difficult to come out of that. The beginning of coming out of that is by observation and application of one's intelligence to understand that actually I'm trying to be happy in this world, but I'm not. And nor is anyone else. Someone might come to the conclusion I'm not happy, but then they'll see others who are happy and they'll try to be like them. And then we get the phenomenon of people imitating persons who are, in their estimation, superior to them. I just flashed into my mind some years back. I think I was traveling in a train, and I saw some boys playing cricket. It is a very common thing in India, boys playing cricket. But I could see by the way that their movements, and one was leaning on the bat. I don't watch cricket on TV, but I can just see that they were imitating professionals who have all these mannerisms. They're not just innocent kids playing cricket, but they're maybe unconsciously they're imitating the movements and of these cricket stars, and you could see in their mannerisms they're imitating the puffed up mannerisms of the cricket stars, because the cricket stars know that they're stars and thousands of people are watching them on TV, and they're quite conscious they're very important people. So the little boy is imitating that because they want to be like that. They got a desire to be like that. I want to, they don't philosophically process it, but they have the idea that I want to be an enjoyer of the world on the level of the cricket star, the big cricket star, who are praised by and adulated, not just praised, adulated, that means highly praised, but to the point of making an icon out of them by so many people, and they earn so much money, and their name is always in the newspaper. So they want to be like that. They want to imitate Krishna is what it comes down to. So understanding that I'm a servant of Krishna, well, that's the theme of the Srimad Bhagavatam, starting from the very beginning. But to actually internalize that and to be as naturally attached to Krishna as we are presently, it seems, naturally attached to the concept of material enjoyment, it's not such a simple thing. It's not a matter of just flipping a switch. Okay, now I'm going to be Krishna conscious. It doesn't happen like that. And we have so many like that desires, misconceptions. When we take to Krishna conscious, even with the intent of just giving ourselves to Krishna, but ourself at the present time, we conceive of ourselves, we're not free of this very strong and deep-rooted concept of myself as an enjoyer of the world. And therefore the desire to be a big or prominent or an enjoyer, that may come into Krishna consciousness, into our whole understanding of Krishna consciousness. That can be dovetailed in some ways. Some ways, for instance, almost all, if not all, of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, as Srila Prabhupada often noted and his disciples admitted, for them a major factor in taking to Krishna consciousness was prasad, because they'd never experienced such tasty food. They were just amazed at how extraordinarily tasty this food is, and we can always tell someone who's at least I haven't been preaching in the West for years, and we don't seem to make so many devotees from Western people these days. But in those days, it was quite common that people would come, and then they'd come, and then you'd talk to them and give them prasad, and within a short time, they'd be full-time members of the movement. That was very common, maybe just overnight. So in such case, you could tell someone is a potential devotee when they eat lots of prasad. They have an attraction. It's somewhat spiritual, because people who are inimical to Krishna, they don't like to take prasadam at all. It's a sign that they've got some attraction to Krishna, but it's also mixed up with some material desire to enjoy the tongue. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada, he often encouraged his early disciples to eat a lot. But on the other hand, he also told in his lectures and his books, he would speak about controlling the tongue and not eating more than necessary. And sometimes he would tell them, I heard this a long time ago, about one devotee who was a sannyasi. And I asked this devotee about this when I met him last, which was about 1.5 years ago. He didn't remember it, but another sannyasi devotee told me there was one incident in which prasadam was being served and this sannyasi had finished. And then some more preparations came, and he wanted to take more. And Prabhupada said, no, you've finished already, a sannyasi, you don't take twice. That's all. That's the standard thing among cultured people. They sit down, take prasad. When you stand up, you don't sit down again and start to eat again. Once you're up, that's it. The meal's finished. You wash your hand and mouth and feet, and it's all over. So that might seem contradictory, but it's an allowance. You may have heard this. Harishari Prabhu explained that when he was in the temple, I believe it was in Sydney, in Australia, they would have every day, bread and chapatis and rice and a sweet and 2 sabjis. And Prabhupada came and said, no, just have very simple sabji every day. Once a week you can have a feast. And he described how some devotees, they would regularly 5 plates of prasadam at one sitting. And Harishari Prabhu himself said he decided to cut down his eating to only 2 plates. The idea was that devotees had come from a position of total immersion in sense gratification. to one of practically nothing. And then the prasadam was their safety valve. They're allowed to indulge in that. It's spiritual. So that's dovetailing. That's one kind of dovetailing one's material desires with something spiritual. It can get more harmful also. If someone has a desire to lord it over others, to use that phrase which we learned from Srila Prabhupada, to dominate others, to make himself prominent, then to be a member of a spiritual movement is a very good vehicle for doing that. Especially when there's the trust and following the leader, and one may want to take a position as a leader and not even be aware that he's doing so. He's dovetailing his material desire, but he doesn't realize he's dovetailing. He thinks it's purely spiritual. See, I want to preach, I want to bring people. And they can't recognize it. And becomes very difficult. It may become very difficult for them to recognize. And sometimes I think of the verse Matyena Krishna Paratasvatova Mitobi Bhadya Jagrihavratanam Adanta Govya Vishatang Tamisram Punapanas Charvata Charvananam. Prahlad Maharaj explains that materialistic people, they are as if determined not to be Krishna conscious by any means. If they may say, I'm looking for the truth. But if you tell them, here's the truth, Krishna, they won't take it. Or they may get together and have a big discussion, philosophical discussion. What is the ultimate truth? Or what is the source of everything? They won't come to Krishna. They're determined not to be Krishna conscious because their underlying motive is to enjoy this material world. And thus, despite, of course I'm paraphrasing the translation here, despite all their high-sounding intentions, actually they're just sense enjoyers and their senses are uncontrolled and they go to hell and repeatedly chew that which has already been chewed. So this doesn't exactly apply to devotees, sometimes you feel like you just can't. People or devotees have certain anarthas, and you just, especially this desire to be recognized, to be a big leader, to have others looking up to you. It's very difficult to they can't to get them to understand that this is not what you're supposed to be doing in Krishna consciousness, because they can't recognize that they're even doing it. And it's, if you say, well, look into your heart. Yeah, I looked into my heart and I found it's completely clean. And tell them, well, many others see that it's like that. No, they don't understand. Guru Maharaj, he knows. But I also see that they're off. But yeah, I'm talking about some of my disciples here. No, it's just a blind spot. They just can't see it. So like that, how to find Krishna? With a material consciousness, a very strong attachment to certain ways of thinking by which we just can't grasp the reality of Krishna, or even in the process of Krishna consciousness, very strong attachment to a certain conception of oneself or desires that one has and desires to fulfill via Krishna consciousness, and they can't work it out. And even if their guru tells them straightforwardly that this is your anartha, they can't accept it. They think, well, Guru Maharaj doesn't understand, or he's just playing a leela with me, or testing me, or other god brothers have turned him against me by complaining again. They just can't find that out. And therefore, it seems, if we examine Srila Prabhupada, how he preached in the West, it seems he was actually very expert in dealing with people, with his disciples also. He certainly didn't accept disciples of a very qualified caliber. If we see in Shastra who is qualified, one of my godbrothers recently, I was speaking with him, Abhiram Prabhu, who he was present on one of the, it seems several times, when Srila Prabhupada said that 50% of my mission is Varnashram, to establish that. So he's taking this very seriously now. And his vision is that, well, we have to train up some children, start with the children. They're the future. It's very difficult to get those who are older to understand all these concepts. So let's start training up some children. And he's been visiting, doing some research, visiting some gurukuls in India. I don't mean those mundane schools that are called gurukul to try to attract pious Hindu parents. I mean, ones in which they train them, actually, according to the traditional system. One school he went to, he told me, the principal or whatever he is, guru, he said that we're not training boys to be slaves of the economic system. He understands the point, which it seems even this man's a Jain, actually. Which Jains are, they're against Vedic culture, although they've adopted much of Vedic culture, but they're against the Vedic, the authority of the Vedas. He understood this point, which it seems even many of our devotees in our movement, even after having so much personal association with Prabhupada and so on and so forth, they didn't understand. So he narrated to Abhiram Prabhu that previously, for a boy to be accepted in the Gurukul, young boy, means he'd be born and raised in a Brahmin home, then the test was that the teacher would recite a Sanskrit shloka and the boy had to repeat it. It means the boy is not expected to know the shloka, but he just has to repeat. He hears it and repeats it. If he does 100 shlokas like that, he's accepted. If not, it's understood that there's some break in the proper transmission of sanskars in the family line of Brahmins, and therefore he's unqualified. So we can see that the family line was there. Boys were accepted as Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras according to birth. But it wasn't just according to birth. The culture had to be there also. And if there's some break, they didn't do the sanskar properly, they didn't retain their tradition properly, therefore this boy is not intelligent enough and not purified enough to be in the Gurukul. Of course, we can't do that because we wouldn't have anyone. There's no, even after having boys in the Gurukul for years and years, we still find, we're not saying this to put them down, but it's just a fact of our Kali Yuga intelligence, that very few, anyone, boys, adults, if you just say a shloka they never heard before once and they can just repeat it, there are not many like that. But even that wasn't the main point of the Gurukul education, it was character training. And the two things are interlinked actually, character and intelligence, purified intelligence, by which one can understand the Supreme Lord. So Srila Prabhupada had just about the opposite kind of background that is required to be a disciple for his disciples. And very deep misconceptions about everything. I'm bringing up this point as it's become somewhat controversial in our society with the publication of a book, Women, Masters, or Mothers. This is a prime example how Srila Prabhupada, he outlined the ideal for Vedic society. In the meantime, he was dealing with people from a very, very different background. And especially Srila Prabhupada referred to the puffed up womanly concept of life. The idea that women should have independence, he was very much against that. Not as a personal grudge or vendetta against women, but based on the Shastra. Srila Prabhupada came to teach Shastra. Even in the very early days when he was just lecturing to people who had no commitment to him, who were just hippies coming to hear, he would always quote from Shastra, which they knew nothing about. They didn't accept its authority. They didn't accept any authority. They had no idea of Sanskrit, but Prabhupada would quote the shlokas and then explain it, because that is the basis of Prabhupada's teaching. So Prabhupada would quote from Manu, Nastriyam Swatantram Arhati, women are not fit for independence. It's a very difficult message for women in the modern age to accept, especially in the West with all the ideas of independence and so on. Srila Prabhupada didn't force it in the West, and in fact he engaged many female disciples in ways commensurate with the abilities which they had developed through education and so on. Even there was one time in Vrindavan, the guest house, many of the rooms were occupied by single women. And Prabhupada told Tejas Prabhu, you tell them, just they should all get out. This is spoiling the atmosphere here. If there are so many single women, first of all, in traditional India, it doesn't look good at all. That's a major consideration, like anti-preaching. So he told Tejas Prabhu, you tell them all to go. Don't say that I did it, otherwise they'll all be angry with me. So in this way, Srila Prabhupada is very diplomatic, you could say. But he made it clear what he wanted the future. He said that the female disciples of my disciples, now here's another interesting point, because in the first canto of Bhagavatam, in one of his purports, which Srila Prabhupada wrote before coming to the West, he wrote that there is no harm in co-education. In other words, if boys and girls go to school together. But he said if there's something happens, then the boy and girl should get married. And then, but then later in a conversation in 1976, I believe, or maybe as late as 1977, Srila Prabhupada, speaking with Tamal Krishna Maharaj, talking about Gurukul, said, no girls. This is very, very dangerous. Keep the boys and girls separate. Use that word, dangerous. So there's an instance where what Srila Prabhupada wrote in his books, generally we take Srila Prabhupada's books as the prime evidence, but then if we see a statement that's recorded and transcribed, that later he modified that, and in fact changed it. So understanding Srila Prabhupada's mood and mission, it really requires Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chetete Koriya Aika to really Arna Kori Hamaniya, to really take his message to heart without interpreting it through our own preconceptions. It's very difficult not to do that, because we all have so many preconceptions. So anyway, I was saying that Srila Prabhupada, his desire for the daughters of our devotees is that they should learn to read and write, and their main education, so they can read Prabhupada's books. And their main education should be the two things. They should learn to be very chaste, they can be a faithful wife, and they should learn to cook very nicely. But Srila Prabhupada didn't force this on his Western women disciples. There's another instance where Srila Prabhupada gave permission to two of his female disciples to have their own little ashram in the country, and he encouraged them in that. But on the same day that he sent a letter to Yamuna and Dinatarini, encouraging them in that, he wrote to the GBC of man of that area and said, this is their defect, that they want to be independent. So on one hand, he could understand that they very much wanted to do this, because Yamuna herself described it. She was very afraid she'd be told to go back to her husband, and she was completely fried, as we say in ISKCON terminology, at the thought of going back to her husband. So Prabhupada said, then you live very simply like this. But he said, don't expand, don't make it very big. Don't try. For women, they can't do cow protection. They want to be, because they're not. So he gave so many restrictions on that, but encouraged them that you be Krishna conscious like that. But in the same day, he sent a letter to the GBC man saying that's their defect, that they want to be independent. So it would appear that Srila Prabhupada was somewhat duplicitous with them, you could say. Not exactly duplicitous, but he dealt with them in a way to encourage them, seeming that this is that they just weren't ready to accept what Srila Prabhupada had to say in this matter. Of course, you may say that's some interpretation, but then we have to consider, why did Srila Prabhupada repeatedly describe so many points about traditional Indian life? It's not just out of some nostalgia. He wanted to reinstitute this. So I'm just giving this as an example that how can we understand Krishna? We have to understand through the Guru. And generally, the Gurus, they have very qualified disciples, and they can instruct them straightforwardly. Education means to bring out in them that knowledge which is inherent within their heart. It's not just a matter of teaching, okay, 1 + 1 = 2, but to help them to understand and to realize, and to help them to become free from their egoism, which blocks proper understanding. There are many cases where devotees thought they were understanding something properly, and Prabhupada just jolted them into showing that they didn't. There was one instant, I don't remember exactly, that Giriraj, Brahmacharya at the time, was talking about some realizations he had of Krishna and Krishna consciousness, and Prabhupada said, oh, that's very nice. Again, that's very nice. And then Giriraj said, but then sometimes it seems like I'm in Maya. And Prabhupada shot back at him, why sometimes? You're always in Maya. So he was thinking, yes, I have this realization. It's so wonderful. Prabhupada's appreciate. And then, no, actually, you're always in Maya. So one can accept that if one is... On the one hand, he's encouraging, but on the other hand, he has to cut. It's like training a horse or something. It's dealing psychologically. You encourage, discipline, both things are there, and try to. But it's not exactly like training a horse, where you give some instruction to them, make some sound, and then the horse or pull the rein. And the horse understands, now I should do this, now I should do that. But it's dealing with a person's whole complex psychology to change it from being that of an enjoyer of this material world to that of being a completely surrendered servant of Krishna. So the guru is the medium who... or the person who helps with that, helps to mold the disciple. And previously, that is considered the ideal model, that few disciples would live in an ashram, and it would be quite intensive. But there are also, of course, different models. Durvasa Muni had 60,000 disciples. So who would travel with him? Daga Rishi is also described as having something like that, 60,000 disciples somewhere. Ramanuja, Shankara, they traveled widely, made disciples here and there, all of Madhavendra Puri also. Traditionally the idea is that the guru is there and trains, correct. Usually starting off with very good material. Now in Kali Yuga, everyone is fallen. By taking to Krishna consciousness, one automatically becomes elevated, but to far elevated above the ordinary people. But to come to the platform of actual pure devotion means to leave behind all misconceptions, all material attachments. Krishna may help in various ways by giving, for instance, setbacks, sickness, disasters in one's life by which one becomes detached from this world. Krishna may help by giving the bitter poison of that helps us to become detached from this material world. On the one hand, we're discussing about establishing Varnashram. On the one hand, we have to have patience in dealing with each individual. On the other hand, to introduce Varnashram means a whole revolution of, it's not just to make the revolution in the way people live will first of all require a revolution in the way they think and act. The way they live, whether they have to agree to that. It's not that they're born into that culture. And no one wants to be designated as a Shudra. And women, they come with this puffed up womanly concept of life. And mostly people don't understand. They think if I have to take a submissive or lower role, that's insulting to me. Not understanding that it's for their own benefit. That ultimately we're not the body, but we have to act according to the situation that is best for us. So it requires a lot of trust for people to even go along with this. And trust is very short in the modern age, in which sannyasira alpa chidra sarva loke gai. A sannyasi's small fault will be broadcast by everyone. So similarly, if someone tries to lead in Krishna consciousness and everyone's looking up to them, little fault, and then everyone, oh, and then they lose faith. They want faith. People grow up without, they don't have the tendency to have faith in anyone because they don't trust anyone because They never had trust in anyone from the very beginning. They never trusted anyone. They don't trust their parents. They may not even know who their father is. They may not even know who their mother is. Or the mother is just someone who's the mother, father, brothers and sisters, they're just people who live in the same house somehow or other. There's not much real relationship or bonding. Young girl leaves home, goes and gets a job some other city, and that's it. They're gone. There's no bonding there. There's no relationship. And we may go to the other extreme, and then seeing that people are so poor in relationships, and in our society of devotees, we just emphasize relationships, and go on. Relationships, and it becomes artificial, that we're always calculating in our mind about our relationship. Whereas in a real strong relationship, you don't think about how I have to cultivate a good relationship. It's just there automatically. So this understanding Krishna, Bahunam Janmanam Ante, a great Mahatma after many births, may understand. In Kali Yuga, It's very, very difficult. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us the holy names of Krishna. We have to chant, all come together and chant and dance and serve Krishna. So chanting, that will help. It will help to carry us over all these obstacles, the chanting of the holy names. Otherwise, it's impossible. But even that chanting, we can turn it into maya. Not that the holy names are maya, but our approach and our attitude can be maya, so that we're trying to enjoy it. And we turn the holy name into some kind of entertainment. So, when we're looking to make this Varnashram and clear understanding of Krishna consciousness, we can simply pray to Srila Prabhupada and Krishna to help us in this endeavor. On the one hand, Krishna consciousness is very easy, but on the other hand, our mind is very wicked. We should beat it with, what is it, shoes in the morning and a broom in the evening. We can just keep on beating it throughout the day, just, and maybe through the night also. Just don't make friends with them. Well, the mind can be the greatest friend and the worst enemy. Atmanam hi atmano bandhur atmaiva ripur atmanaha. One has to elevate oneself with one's mind, not degrade oneself. The mind can be our greatest friend or our worst enemy. So we have to elevate ourselves with the help of mind. How does that verse begin? One has to elevate oneself with the help of the mind. But then the mind is materially contaminated. So it becomes a dilemma how to do so. And then how to get out of this conundrum. Savai mana Krishna padaravindaya. The sankalpa, the intent, the firm intention that now I must place my mind at the lotus feet of Krishna. Ultimately, our sincerity, if we have it, will carry us through. If not, if we don't have that sincerity, that desire to fully submit ourselves to Krishna, then we might get stuck for a few lifetimes. Hare Krishna. Any comment or question about this, please? No. All right. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Hare Krishna.